Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. So that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us from Annapolis, Maryland, Michael Perutka. Michael, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Dr. Stan, it's an honor to be on with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. And, of course, I understand that your right-hand man, Pastor David Whitney, is down there in Montgomery, Alabama, with the demonstration in favor of the Ten Commandments.
Yes, he is. As a matter of fact, I just saw him last night on NBC News, a little news clip. I guess he had given just a short interview there. And he has been doing just a wonderful job of standing up, standing in the gap, and being where he believes in his heart he needs to be right now.
But, you know, of course, we've never had a time when I think it's more important that the American people understand the foundations of our freedom, that America was founded as a Christian republic. It was founded on Judeo-Christian principles. The Ten Commandments is certainly honored by both the Jews and by the Christians. All of our laws are based upon the Ten Commandments. That's the basis of law. And, of course, I think that the great tragedy of today is that nobody wants to come out and say, quite frankly, what we're dealing with is not the ACLU or the Americans United for Church and State for Separation of Church and State. We're dealing with an anti-Christian conspiracy to destroy the very foundations of this nation. America is under attack on all sides, but specifically there's an effort to destroy the religious foundation of our nation. Why doesn't anybody want to talk about that?
Well, because, Dr. Stan, there's a number of reasons, and people have written books about this, but I would just try to capsulize it like this. You know, if you and I were in a war with each other, if you and I were mortal enemies, wouldn't it be a tremendous advantage for you if I didn't know the war was going on?
I think that's exactly what it's all about, and the tragedy is that nobody's telling our people that the war is going on, and even more than that, why most people don't really understand the foundations of our freedom, which is the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and the Declaration of Independence.
Sure, we've been lulled to sleep. As a matter of fact, that monument that we've been talking about on the news so much in Alabama, and where Pastor Whitney is now, you know, on the top of that monument is the Ten Commandments. But around the base of it are other things that would be very, I think, enlightening if they were announced and talked about. On the one side, it says the laws of nature and of nature's God from the Declaration of Independence. There are quotations around that monument that are part of our American history, and they reflect that foundation of moral law that all our forefathers shared and understood and was part of the culture then. But as you know, and I'm sure as some of your listeners know, that what has occurred is that there has been a revolution in worldview. We have left that worldview of our founders and our grandfathers and great grandfathers, where they understood that if man's law is not in harmony with God's law, then in fact it is not law. And our forefathers understood that distinctly, and that's why God's law was in front of them all the time. But see, a revolution has occurred, and not only aren't people being told about our history, it's deliberately being hidden. It's deliberately being covered up. You know that it's not taught in the government schools. You know that it's not that 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 these attitudes and worldviews of our founders and the very documents of our founding are no longer taught in school. And I'm sure on your program you've talked about this Goals 2000 for the public schools, etc., and the effects of that, where Gloria Steinem is mentioned 18 times and George Washington is not mentioned at all, or maybe mentioned once. That is not an accident, Dr. Stan.
And of course it isn't. And of course that's the policy that's being pushed by our president. And the president says, well, of course, he's not down there demonstrating in front of Judge Roy Moore or trying to protect him. He's saying, well, we have to obey the laws. But what are the laws based upon? The Constitution. And what has the First Amendment said? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Doesn't say that Alabama can't, doesn't say that Judge Roy Moore can't. It says Congress shall not. Why? Because they didn't want the federal government or any judges telling people at the state and local level what they were going to do. And at the time when those words were written, I think, 9 or 10 of the states had their own state religion. Now, the states eventually did away with them and allowed people to do whatever they wanted to, but we had prayer in our schools and the VMI, and of course prayer was such an important part of our society. Acknowledgement of God certainly is a part of the inaugural address of every single one of our presidents, including both Bill Clinton and George Herbert Walker Bush and George W. Bush. But of course, we can't, of course, mention God in our schools, although they can open the Supreme Court every day when the choir comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. What's this really all about? Well, it's about removing any knowledge of God from our children and our schools, because, of course, we can create just one generation of a secular society. Why we have destroyed the Christian foundations of this nation, and America as we know it will never again be the same. Well, of course, for our listeners out there, Mike Perutka and his brother have put together the Institute of the Constitution at their own expense and with great work on their part. They are trying to get people all across America to set up training programs to rekindle that spark of freedom that once blazed so brightly in the minds and hearts of the American people, and to teach them about the Constitution. Mike, why don't you tell our listeners what the Institute of the Constitution is and why, if they really care about themselves, they really care about their children and the future of this nation, they need to get a packet and set up an Institute of the Constitution in their community.
Well, I'd be happy to, and I thank you for the opportunity of doing this. This is exciting, Dr. Stan, because what the Institute on the Constitution is, really, it is a tool. It's just a tool that helps us to recover our own history and get and reestablish contact with our own heritage. We have put together a 12-part videotape lecture series that goes through the history of the Republic, gives a good understanding of the biblical view of law and government, and then deals with the religious worldview and the philosophical worldview of our founders. It traces through the constitutional period itself when it was founded and when it was written, and also talks about specifically about the Articles. So it's an education. It's civics. It's an education in our own history, in our own heritage. This has been lost today, and we need to recover. This is very, very important. So as what we encourage people to do, if they want to learn more about it and get our program and then teach it to others, use it to inform others, they can call us at 410-760-9068, or they can contact us at www.iotconline.com. That's our website.
Give those once again, because you have to give at least 3 times before people have a chance to get out their pen and paper and write them down. What is the telephone number again?
Again, it's 410-760-9068.
All right.
And then the website again, and a lot of information can be gotten from that. And it's, as a matter of fact, there's also some information on there about what's going on in Alabama, and it ties in what we're doing with that. And that's www.iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. And so people can get information from there. And, we need this information. We need it in our arsenal. We need it, because without it, we're lost. You know, I was thinking, Dr. Stan, quite aside from the attack that you talked about on our history and on our culture, cultural. There's, in Alabama, a stark legal argument as well. There's a real jurisdiction argument here. If you read the First Amendment and the Tenth Amendment together, you understand that the federal government has no place. It has no legal authority to be speaking to the whatever religion is practiced in Alabama, or whatever the people of Alabama want to do with respect to their religious liberties. The federal government has no place, has no role. If I, Dr. Stan, came over to your house as a guest, if you invited me over as a guest, and I sat there and ate a meal at your house, I would have authority to eat that meal. But if then I started ordering around your wife and telling her how she should cook the meal, and then started telling her how she should clean her house, then I started giving orders to your children, well, you know, that first, when I first stepped out of line there, you might let me go, but very soon you're going to stand up and say, no, no, no. You're outside your jurisdiction here, Michael. You're outside. You have no authority to do this. And that's what Chief Justice Moore has done in Alabama here. He said no to the federal courts. You don't have authority.
And I really think it's so important that our listeners understand that the founding fathers of America feared the power of government. And, of course, everything was done to check power, because they realized that men were inherently corrupt, men were inherently evil. And, of course, in fact, that was the concepts of Samuel Rutherford, that all men were created equal. He wrote that in a book called Lex Rex, The Law is King. And he said all men are created equal. They're all created in sin. And that's why, of course, the king being created in sin shouldn't have a right, of course, to control of the commoner who is created in sin. All men are created equal. And those ideas then were, of course, transmitted and codified in our Declaration of Independence. But it was because men were sinful that they set up a system of checks and balances so that you had an executive and a judicial and a legislative, and each one could negate the other. And any time our Congress wants to negate the Supreme Court, they can simply limit their appellate jurisdiction or impeach the Supreme Court justices who have gone over and taken precedence from the United Nations or the European Union introduce into our laws. In other words, these men have sworn to uphold our Constitution and they're not doing it. But of course, even more than the checks and balances between within the federal government was the check and balance between the federal and the state government. And all matters having to do with life, liberty, and property were to be dealt with at the state level. And if you don't believe that, that's what's intended. You get out your Federalist Papers, and if you don't have them, we offer them through Radio Liberty, and read the 45th Federalist Papers. And, of course, the powers of the central government were to be limited and defined and have nothing to do with religion. The power of the state government was to be unlimited and ill-defined. And, of course, then we were going to have checks and balances between the state and the local government and try to bring all matters as close to the people as possible, because they did not trust government. And of course, as Thomas Jefferson said, when all power has been centralized in Washington, we will have a government that is as venal and authoritarian as the one we've just separated from. And ladies and gentlemen, that's just what's happening now. And the fact that you're not being told this, you're being told that the words, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, somehow says that we can't have a Ten Commandments in our local courthouse or a major scene on the law of our city hall. And of course it doesn't mean that. It's simply they're confusing the words because they hate Christianity. And once we understand that this is a conspiracy against God, then it all begins to make sense. And you can understand why the entire media and almost everybody within the government is against Judge Roy Moore. I think it tells us a lot about the people who control the media and who control our government. And I'm so disappointed that our Christian president isn't down there demonstrating with the people in Montgomery, Alabama tonight.
Oh, he could. Our quote-unquote Christian president, Dr. Stan, could solve this problem easily in a number of ways. He has a number of things at his control. First of all the federal marshals in the Department of Justice work for him. He doesn't have to enforce what the federal court has dictated. And he could, as you say, because of he has a check on that because of his position, he could do that. As you also mentioned, the Congress could limit the appellate authority of the federal courts, and this matter would be over. In fact, that's they have no authority to do the things that they're doing. And you know, it's interesting. Judge Roy Moore is being depicted here as the lawbreaker, when in fact he is the law keeper. He has made an oath to the Constitution of Alabama, the Constitution of the United States, and that Constitution is the law.
And of course, that Constitution includes a dedication to God of the state of Alabama. Mentions God. In fact, the constitutions of every one of our initial 48 states talked about God. Even here in California, the godless state. Why the first sentence of our Constitution talks about God? Isn't it strange that, of course, that the Congress opens every day with a prayer, and the Senate opens every day with a prayer, and there's a replica of the Ten Commandments in the building where the Supreme Court sits, right above where the Chief Justice sits, but somehow they found that it's illegal to have any mention of God in our local communities, in a public place. You would think the American people would be smart enough to see through this. But, of course, nobody's really telling them, are they?
Well, that's what we're trying to do, Dr. Stan, and that's really the point here. Yes, America, they could not get away with this unless we didn't know our history and know our Constitution. So the answer is, a big part of the answer is, we must now go back and rebuild our understanding of our own history and our own laws. So that's what Instituted on the Constitution is about. I urge your folks, please learn more about it. Get involved. 410-760-9068. We will help you with this. We kiddingly say we lose $5 on every kit, but we're going to make it up in volume. we are committed to changing this circumstance, this situation in America. We will do all we can to aid you and assist you to learn what you need to know, and to educate others in your church, in your community, in your basement, in your family. These should be the discussions that go on around your dinner table, not about, you know, who's going to marry a millionaire. This is what you should be discussing with your children. And if your children are grown, get them back over to dinner and go through this program with them. And because this is what they need to teach their children. This is our heritage. When our preamble says we must secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, that is our calling, and that is our heritage, and that is our job and our duty that our forefathers have given to us and that we've been given by God to pass this knowledge on. I know you might need to go to a break, Dr. Stan. I'm sorry to hold you up here.
You're ready. Look, you'll hear the music. Don't worry.
Okay. I thought I did. That's why. But you know, James Madison is considered to be the father of the Constitution, and the federal court only needed to read what James Madison said about the Ten Commandments and American civilization. He said this. He said, "We have staked the whole future of American civilization not upon the power of government, far from it. We have staked the future upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves, to sustain ourselves, according to the Ten Commandments of God." Now, how can a federal court, under color of law, make such a ridiculous ruling and then expect it to be enforced by the Chief Justice of Alabama when it itself is lawless?
Well, of course, but the president's going right along with this, and the attorney general's going right along with this, and we have to ask ourselves, what is their real motivation? Are they what they purport to be, or are they part of this whole agenda, saying one thing and doing another? Because, you see, this is really a watershed event for America. They have crossed the Rubicon. They've come out. It's very obvious there is a conspiracy against God. And the question is, what are God's people going to do? What is your church going to do? And, of course, your church isn't going to do anything. Well, then maybe you've got to do something.
Right.
Because men and women become accomplices of the evils they fail to oppose. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Mike Perutka, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Mm-hmm. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and while our listeners up there in the Great Northwest are just taking a four-minute break from us, why, we'll continue on here with Mike Pootka. But, you know, the thing is that this is one of the major issues in the news, and everything you read tells you how just terrible Judge Roy Moore is. Why, he isn't upholding the law. It's the purpose of the judges to uphold the law. Well, the thing is, he is upholding the law. He has read the Constitution, which is the foundation upon which all other laws built. And of course, here in the United States, our laws are built upon the Bible. In fact, why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England? And for our listeners who don't know, Mike Pootka is a lawyer, but he's one of the good lawyers who's giving of himself and his time and his effort really to help rekindle that spark of freedom that is just about to be extinguished here in America. So tell us about Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England and why they are so apropos to this entire discussion.
Well, you know, our founders, there was a study done, Dr. Stan, by a man named Lutz and Heinemann some years ago, and the study looked through all the different quotations of the founders to see who they were quoting in their writings, in their letters, in their writings. In other words, what did they consider a source of authority that they would quote? And to a large extent, to the greatest extent, I think 34% of all the quotations of the framers of the Constitution came from the Bible. The Bible was the source that they were quoting. For the most part, they were quoting Deuteronomy, it's the book of the law. They were quoting Exodus and Leviticus. And next to that, the next most quoted were both Montesquieu and Blackstone. Blackstone wrote, was quoted a great deal. He had written something called the Commentaries of the Laws of England. It's a compilation of the common law, if you will, of England. And although I went to law school, Dr. Stan, I never realized, I had heard about Blackstone, but I never realized that what Blackstone was quoting in his commentaries on the laws of England, again, was scripture, as was Montesquieu in his work, The Spirit of the Laws. This was the law, the common law of England that was passed on to us in America, was greatly based on the case law and the Ten Commandments and the case law of the Bible. The Bible is replete with case law and, how judges should rule in certain matters, and the principles there were what Blackstone used as the basis of his commentaries on the laws of England. Now, early in American history, Dr. Stan, in early American courtrooms, Blackstone was quoted all the time. Eijmo says many an argument was settled by a quotation from Blackstone, so it was a well known and recognized source. When I went to law school, now this is some years ago too, not back at the founding, but some years ago, when I was in law school, I had seen references to Blackstone, but of course was never really encouraged to look them up, and I'm not blaming anybody else, I really should have, but there was an effort to take Blackstone and remove his references from American, from cases and from American law. And of course, I didn't see it then like I am able to see it and talk about it now. But the pattern there, the distinct pattern...
I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're going to have to bring our listeners in back from Washington. Well, Dr. Stan, and our guest is, of course, Mike Pootka, and he's been talking about Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England. Now, you have to understand that Blackstone was foundational to the law in the United States, and for the first 100 or so years here in the United States, all of our laws were based upon Blackstone's writings in his commentaries on the laws of England. And what was Blackstone's writings based upon? Why, of course, on the Bible. In fact, it said that Charles Finney, who led the Second Great Awakening, had started out to study to be a lawyer. And after reading Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, he changed his major and became one of the great ministers of the 19th century. So, but of course, you see, this isn't taught today. Oh, we're told, oh no, we have man's laws. We have Supreme Court justices who swear to uphold the Constitution, and then, of course, Well, they go over to Europe to find out what they're doing there. Or they get commentaries on how normal and healthy homosexuality is. Or they go to the United Nations Charter to find out about our laws and what they should be. Ladies and gentlemen, these people are not fit to even enter the Supreme Court. And it's about time there was an outcry from the American people. This old, we're a nation of laws. No, law is based upon God's law. And once we repudiate that, once we repudiate God, do you honestly believe that God is not going to repudiate America? That's what this is really all about. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the soul of America, and this may well be your last chance to be involved in the effort to save this country. So really, we have to get people to understand what has really taken place. And I will tell you something that they never talk about in churches today, and that is the wrath of God. But all you need to do is read the Old Testament and see what happened there again and again and again to the nations that turned against God. And don't think for one minute it's not going to happen here. So go ahead and pick up the story there from Mike.
Well, thank you. As you were saying, much of our early jurisprudence in America used Blackstone as a reference. Blackstone has, over the last 50 and 60 years, and maybe longer than that, I've been shoved aside, Dr. Stan, and of course, if you see this pattern and you understand the revolution that's been taking place, the socialist Marxist revolution that's been taking place in America, you can see why, and you can also then understand why it's so important to the socialist mindset, which is an anti-Christian mindset, that monument down there, just as Blackstone needs to be removed by these people, they want to remove it from American jurisprudence and not have him referred to, for the same reason they can't stand that monument that Roy Moore, the Chief Justice Roy Moore, put in the Alabama Judicial Building Rotunda. Because it, you know, they say that they're offended by this monument. Now you know, on one level, you and I would say, well, give me a break. You can't walk to your office and walk past this thing with that. Well, how does it offend you? But you know, in a sense, Dr. Stan, they're right. They're evilly right, because they are offended by this. If you understand where they're coming from,
amen.
Their belief is that the state is God, and of course they'll control and manipulate the state's actions. But they believe the state is God. They don't believe, and if they see that monument really represents a competing God, the real God. That God is God. And that is very troublesome to those who want to manipulate others and control others by using the state and claiming that the state is divine. So that's really at the heart of this. And they get over on us using federal courts, etc., because we don't know our own laws. We don't know the basis of our laws, the source of our laws. We've grown complacent and lazy, and that's what we have to get out of. I want to exhort your listeners, if they feel that something is wrong in America, if they are not comfortable with the dictates of a court, and by the way, this is the same court that brought you Roe v. Wade. This is the same court that brought you abortion. It brought you sodomy. It took abortion and sodomy from despicable criminal acts and gave them and made them into civil rights. And that's the court that you're going to say, oh, well, if this judge says that this is law, that this federal judge says this is law, now we've got to remove our monument. That's who you're dealing with here. You're dealing with an out-of-control, lawless federal judiciary. It's been lawless for a long time. But the fact that an error is repeated many times does not remove it from being an error. It's still an error. I sometimes, when my brother and I get into heated debates, I say to him, Dr. Stan, Steve, it doesn't matter how long you say that or how loud you say that, that doesn't make it true.
All right, we're going to be back here in just a moment. And, of course, we're going to invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We're told we're a nation of laws, but whose laws? Man's law or God's law? And because once we turn or get back against God, do you honestly think that God won't turn his back on America? Yeah. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening is Mike Perutka. We're talking about the Institute of the Constitution, and we're hoping that many of you out there certainly will be willing to get involved in this. You know, if you don't, who will, and if not now, when? I mean, freedom, you think, is something that can be maintained by watching American baseball, by, of course, cheering for your favorite football team, by paying your taxes. No, freedom will only be maintained when there are enough people who really believe in it to make a personal sacrifice and to help us educate others and rekindle that flame which is close to extinction today, that flickering flame of freedom that was passed to us from generations past, but we will not be able to pass on to generations in the future. So if you're out there, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. I'd like to know what you think. Do you think Judge Roy Moore was right? Do you think Judge Roy Moore was wrong, that actually, of course, he should be abiding by the law? But, of course, whose law are we talking about? And that, of course, is the major, major question. In fact, if you go back and you read Thomas Jefferson, you know, he talked about how he saw within the Constitution of our federal judiciary the seeds of the destruction of our way of life. For he said, like a group of men with an agenda, working like a thief by night, taking a little here, a little there, until eventually all powers shall be centralized in Washington, D.C., and we shall have a government as venal as that we've recently separated from. He was writing this in the early 1800s. He saw how this was going to happen, and of course, for those of you who haven't read the wonderful book, it's called Philip II Administrator. It was written in 1911 by Colonel Edward Mandel House, and Colonel House was, of course, deeply involved in the occult. He was the key figure in the Wilson administration and in the Roosevelt administration and up until about 1936 when Colonel House died. But he talked about how you would declare a dictatorship in America. This was the plan of Philip II Administrator. And one of the things to do was, of course, to appoint people to the Supreme Court who believed in a positive central government rather than a limited central government. You see, the secret of America was the power of the central government was limited, and we could hammer out our differences at the state and the local level. Never, of course, looking to the central government to solve our problems, because although we may have injustice at the state or local level, we can always either fight it and succeed or pick up and move. But where do you move to when, of course, you have a corrupt central government and, of course, an authoritarian central government that takes away the rights and freedoms of the people? And, of course, that's what nobody ever asked. That's why we had this concept of states' rights and matters dealing with life, liberty, and property would be handled at the state level. What would your response to that be, Mike?
Well, I was just thinking as you were quoting Jefferson, Dr. Stan, you know, Jefferson also said that anyone who desires to be ignorant and free desires what never was and never will be. And it strikes me as we talk about Jefferson that that's really the situation that we're in now. As you were talking about, the we're going to be American and we're going to have our freedoms by singing the national anthem at a football game and by throwing a baseball or whatever. Then there's nothing wrong with baseball and football, but as recreation. But while we are fiddling, Rome is burning, and while we are being ignorant of our freedoms, those who would seek to take them away from us, and those exist, we will end up by coercion, by force, by nibbling away here and there, we lose our freedoms. If what's happening in Alabama does not wake you up, then you may never wake up. You may never wake up. Your children will grow up, the public schools will tell them that they're free, all the while enslaving and drugging them and dumbing them down, and you will miss, you will have ensured that your children are slaves. You will have not passed on the blessings of liberty to your posterity. You'll pass down the chains of slavery. We have this, Dr. Stan, I have in my office a young lady who's currently in law school. She just began law school. She told me this morning that she had been with a couple of other students who were mocking Roy Moore just this morning, saying, he doesn't understand separation of church and state. Now, this young lady has been to Institute of the Constitution classes, and she asked them where the word separation or church or state was in the First Amendment. And it just stopped their conversation dead.
Sure.
They really had no comeback. There is, unless you know your Constitution, unless you know your history, you will fall for big lies like separation of church and state. That's one of the things, by the way, in the course we deal with. We want you to be able to articulate why that's a lie and be able to walk into situations like that young lady walked into this morning and be able to straighten out that situation and speak the truth and convince others that they have bought a lie and be able to give them the information that they need. Separation of church and state is just one of the huge lies that's been perpetrated on us.
We're going to have to take I'm going to ask Nathan to hang on, but right now we've got Tony calling on his cell phone. So, hi, Tony, how are you doing?
Oh, fine. Thanks for taking my call. I've got two questions. Concerning the Ten Commandments monument, first of all, with
the Tenth Amendment or Ten Commandments?
The Ten Commandments.
Okay.
The one in Alabama.
Right.
I would like to know when Judge Moore became Speaker of the House and a member of Congress and passed a law establishing religion. That's my first.
I think what the caller is referring to, Dr. Stan, is that it says Congress shall make no law, and of course he didn't do that. He didn't become a member of Congress or make a law.
I was under the impression that he was a state judge.
No, he is the Supreme Court judge of the state of Alabama. He was elected to that position. And he says, you see, Tony, if you read what he said, he talks about how the Alabama Constitution talks about God and their obligation to God. And, of course, this is the basis of his defense of the Ten Commandments because, of course, this is God's law. And, of course, he is to be true to the Constitution of Alabama and the Supreme Court and the supreme law of the United States. And, of course, there is no place within the federal judiciary, within our Constitution, that says Congress shall have anything to do with religion at the state or the local level. But they've simply usurped the power, and, of course, because they have an agenda, and that is, of course, our judges hate Christianity.
Well, I agree with you, but I know that this may sound ludicrous, but this whole thing is ludicrous. Since when? I mean, I think the question should be asked, did Congress pass law establishing a religion when a federal judge says that's exactly what happened and this is a violation of the First Amendment? When this is a state judge in the state of Alabama who's not a member of Congress and did not pass an act of Congress. Mm-hmm. I mean, the First Amendment's quite plain.
Okay, fine. What's your second point, Tony?
Well, it's funny. I was just reading this gentleman's website about an hour ago, and I know this is a little off the subject, but there was a story there about a fellow who was working with Gary Hart, and now he's in exile, and I think his name was Matthews, and I couldn't quite figure out what all that was about. I mean, that's really, and then now he's on the radio. I know it's a little off the subject. But
okay, well, it's just a little off the subject. What side are you talking about?
Pardon me?
What website are you talking about?
The one about the... I had a link to Jeff Metcalf, the Constitution, Restore the Constitution.
Do you have a question that would have anything to do with what we're talking about?
If he had about 30 seconds just to maybe mention if he knows what I'm talking about.
I don't know what you're talking about. Do you know what he's talking about?
I'm sorry, Tony. I'm not familiar with, if there is a link on our website going to somebody named Matthews, it might be a link to a link. I'm not aware of what that is.
Oh, that's fine.
Can I help you? Thanks so much, Tony.
Thank you.
God bless. And let's go to Nathan, okay? Nathan's been waiting patiently on the line. Go ahead, Nathan. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, that's quite all right. I'm not really going to discuss the First Amendment, you know, the Tenth Amendment versus incorporation. I'd really rather discuss and get your guest's comment on the actual issue of the Ten Commandments itself. And let me just put the question like this. Do you not agree that it is hypocritical to the max for Judge Moore's associate justices and the higher court to rule that the Ten Commandments is, quote, religion, end quote, whereas in practically every federal building, every state building, and in many local communities, there are actual Greek gods and goddess statues. You have a statue of Ishtar towering over New York City. You have obelisk. You have all manner of polytheistic religions. We have Christmas, so-called, which is a pagan holiday. You have all manner of non-monotheistic forms of worship that are state-sanctioned, and yet something that actually is true, something that actually is a revelation of God, i.e. the Ten Commandments, they want to take it out of the courthouse. And I also wonder why it is that the Jewish community, which should be standing up in defense of Jewish heritage and also the Jewish mission to spread monotheism throughout the nations, why it's taking, at least the mainstream Jewish organizations, are taking the other side, taking the Hellenistic side against the Jewish side. I guess it's really more of a comment than a question, but I think we can get away from, get on to, the Constitution is on a secondary level to the Ten Commandments, and I think that that should really be the focus right there, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, but what would be the focus? The fact that the Ten Commandments is the basis of both the Jewish and the Christian faith, they're holy to both of them, and it appears that...
As I understand, 99% of the population, at least nominally, identifies as either Jewish or Christian.
Okay, well, at least...
We are Muslim. I mean, it's the mainstream... Monotheism is the main, okay.
But of course, we have put people into the judicial system who hate the God of the Bible. That's what it's all about, I think. But let's get Mike's view. Thanks so much for calling, Nathan. And let's go ahead. Dude, what was your thought on, what Nathan is saying?
Well, I appreciate Nathan's first comment there. I agree. It's kind of interesting to note that the federal courthouse in Montgomery, from which this decision emanated from, it actually has a pagan statue outside of its front door, a pagan god. I can't remember exactly what the god is, but I heard this talked about. Dr. John Eidsmo mentioned this, and of course, what's at issue here is the Ten Commandments that Judge Roy Moore put, but yet they have a pagan god. And that brings up, kind of touches on a point that Nathan brings up that we talk about in the classes, Dr. Stan, and that has to do with what we call the myth of neutrality. We have this, we sometimes fall into this this situation where we think, well, that's religious and over here is secular. And in a true sense, there is really no secular. When we talk about, people say you can't legislate morality. Well, of course, morality is all you can really legislate. Whenever we pass a law, especially something that has criminal sanctions, we are implicitly saying that something is good and something is bad, something is right and something is wrong. Well, where do we get those standards? We get them from our religious beliefs. Now, your religious belief might be that there is no God, but that's a religious belief. If your religious belief is that that Buddha is God, then that's a religious belief. So there really is no neutral ground. We are going to, if we have civil government, we are going to follow some kind of morality. And our country and our nation, our founders decided we would follow the Ten Commandments and biblical law. And that, and we talked earlier in the program about how Blackstone is an example of that. But it's a mistake to say that we can just remove religion from civil government. That's actually impossible. So I think Nathan is right on when he says, hypocrisy to the max? Of course it is. It's hypocrisy quite beyond the max.
But of course the thing is, Mike, what is so strange is that most of our religious leaders just don't want to take a real strong stand, or they say, oh yes, yeah, it's all right what he's doing, but we are still a nation of law. We've got to obey the laws. But whose laws? The God, laws of God upon which our nation was founded, the laws of people who hate God, which is, of course, the tragedy of what's taking place today. And when you have people in our Supreme Court who swear to uphold the Constitution and lie, Then, of course, our country's in real trouble. But why should we be surprised if they lie? Lying seems to be increasingly accepted everywhere in our nation today, in our corporate structure, in our presidents, whether it would be Bill Clinton, who says, you know, of course, well, it just really matters what the definition of is really is. And, of course, nothing is done to him. Or,
right.
Well, we could give you many other examples of presidents lying to the American people.
Dr. Stan, that's another issue that we deal with in our class discussions in Institute on the Constitution. We deal with the myth, as well as the myth of neutrality and the myth of separation of church and state. There's this myth we have that a man's private life and his public life don't, that this private life doesn't affect his public life. Like, he can be a, you know, he can be an adulterer, he can be a liar, he can be a thief. Oh, but he does a great job running the country. That is so patently ridiculous. And our, you know, our founders and our grandfathers and our grandmothers would have spanked us for saying such a stupid thing. It's, of course, a ridiculous thing. When you elect somebody to office, Dr. Stan, you know, you're going to see what they do in your sight. Less than 1% of the things they do are ever going to really be transparent to you. Most of the things they do are going to be behind closed doors and away from you. What you really should be concerned about is the man's character. His character is what you should care about. And during the Clinton years especially, we got heavy doses of this myth that character doesn't count. Well, that's, you know, if we don't wake up and smell the coffee there, we're in big trouble. But that's another thing that we deal with at some length in our course, because we think it's a very, very important myth that needs to be dispelled so that we can understand what's going on.
Okay, well, let's go to Mike calling. Hi, Mike. How are you doing?
Hi, Stan. The pagan god your guest was referring to is the Greek goddess Themis. They have a sculpture of her at the federal courthouse just a few blocks away from Judge Roy Moore's court.
Well, maybe we ought to, of course, bring a lawsuit because, of course, that is certainly a god as well.
Certainly. I don't see any difference except for what the two stand for. But that's a religion.
Okay, fine. Anything else?
You know, thank you very much for picking up on that. You're exactly right.
Yeah. And that's from the Eidsmo piece. You probably have a copy of the same thing.
Wait a minute. How come I don't have a copy of it? What is it, Mike?
You're just in the dark about everything.
I know. I have to depend on you to keep me abreast of what's going on.
Yeah.
Where was John Eidsmo's piece published?
Hmm?
We have it on our website.
All right.
I'll find the date.
All right. Don't worry about it.
It's called A Call to Stand, and Eidsmo came out with it a couple of days ago. It's really his brief on this whole issue of Roy Moore and the Ten Commandments.
And that's really what's so important for our listeners, to know where you can go to get the information. Go to IOTC, Institute on the Constitution, online.com, IOTConline.com. Get that article, read it through 3 or 4 times. Judge Roy Moore wrote an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal about 2 days ago. Read that. See what he has to say, and then be able to discuss this intelligently with the turkeys out there that really, will simply cackle and repeat what we said. Oh, you know, he doesn't understand the wall of separation between church and state. And I think the remark of the young lady in your office, Mike, well, where did it say anything in the First Amendment about wall, separation, or church?
I think the only word in there is of. I think the word of is in the first.
Anything else, Mike?
Well, maybe the word is must be in there.
Right.
But, of course, is doesn't mean is.
Right.
What does it mean?
Well, go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, what I really called about, Mike referred to a few minutes ago about these grade school kids that knew more than Judge Roy Moore did about the separation of church and state.
No, but these actually are apparently law students.
Law students?
Right.
Oh, okay.
First-year law students. But, they know about as much as most kids in grammar school. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I just wondered how they got so smart.
Well, I'll tell you what, you know, we have pretty good intelligence, you know, we're in grammar school, but by the time you get through going through college and you've read Hegel and Marx and Nietzsche and Kant, you know, they've destroyed everything you believe in, and you really don't know what you believe anymore. And then at that point, you're willing to simply babble on anything you read in Time magazine or Newsweek magazine or U.S. News, and you think you're intelligent. And, of course, you don't realize that you've been conditioned by the people who control your mind.
I think Babylon is the operative word in your statement there.
Okay.
But maybe those guys will just have to wait till they're the same age as Roy Moore and see how bright they are.
Right. Well, but Roy Moore, of course, didn't know a lot of these things initially.
Right.
And actually, it was long after he got out of law school, he actually read the Constitution and suddenly realized he had been lied to in college. And the same thing happened with me. I was lied to in college. And it took a long time after I got out of college to learn the facts and the truth about America's history and what freedom is really all about.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, thanks so much, Mike. Okay, that's the other Mike, of course. And with us now is Mike Perutka from the Institute on the Constitution. And if you have a question or a comment, the telephone number 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But, you know, if you're out there and you're wondering, well, you know, maybe I'll get around to doing something sometime in the future. Well, remember, if we don't take America back, you don't have a future, and neither do your children or grandchildren. And what are you going to say to them when freedom has been lost? Well, I was just too busy. I didn't have time. Call 410-760-9068. That's 410-760-9068. Or go to the website iotconline.com, iotconline.com, and learn about the Institute of the Constitution. And here's something that everybody in the listening audience can do if you really care about your future, your freedom, and your family.
Dr. Stan, on that website, we also have up a little clip we did. I was in Alabama last weekend for the rally, and I was able to make do a couple of interviews in the crowd, and I was able to interview Dr. Joe Moorcraft, Pastor Joe Moorcraft, and some others, and Alan Keyes as well. And we have a little video clip on the website that you can go to. And Alan Keyes, in about 3 minutes, actually summarizes the legal arguments here quite concisely and quite well. So we were able to get that up on the website, too. And
well, now, what was his basic argument? I mean, well, after all, the Supreme Court is held and the federal judge is held. So how does he counter the fact that if we're a nation of laws, don't we have to obey the laws as laid out by the courts?
Well, he points out, of course, in Article 6 of the Constitution, the federal Constitution clearly says that it is the supreme law of the land, not a judge's opinion. The Constitution is the supreme law. Article 5 points out a way to change the Constitution if you want to. It provides for an amendment process, and that's provided in the Constitution if we want to change it. And, of course, we don't change it by court order. We change it by the amendment process contained in it. And, of course, he talks about the First Amendment as we have tonight, and the Tenth Amendment indicates that any power not given specifically to the federal government is reserved to the states and the people. So, and Congress shall make no law. That's one of the areas that the federal government cannot involve themselves in. So, he points out quite well how this order on the part of a federal judge is a lawless order, and he makes the point that under color of law they're trying to eradicate the substance of liberty.
That's beautiful. Under the color of law, they're trying to eradicate the substance of liberty. And, of course, you know, the argument that they're going to use, well, but the 14th Amendment, you take the 14th Amendment, and then you take the First Amendment, you mix them up together in this salad bowl, and you get Martha Stewart to pull out the tag, and it says, well, now, of course, neither the federal government nor the state government, neither Congress nor the state government shall make any law respecting the establishment of religion. But, you know, there was nothing in the 14th Amendment for 100 or at least for 90 years that had anything to do with religion. They simply made that up out of whole cloth, didn't they?
Well, see, of course, the same argument we just said a moment ago, Article 5 of the Constitution says how you can amend it. You, it's for the amendment process. The 14th Amendment does not, it is an amendment, of course, but it doesn't say that the Bill of Rights is applicable to, can now be enforced against the states. It doesn't say that. And just because a court says it says that, doesn't mean it says that. That's again, under the color of law, under the color of a court order that looks like law, they're trying to eradicate the substance of liberty. And so that's what we have to... But see, we can't protect ourselves from these actions unless we educate ourselves and know our rights and know our Constitution and know our history. They're going to get over on you unless you know what you're talking about.
And of course, people have to be able to quote that First Amendment. They've got to be able to quote the reason for government. And governments are instituted among men to preserve these rights. Governments are instituted among men, deriving their power from the consent of the governed. That's what the Declaration says. That's why you have a government. It's to guarantee our God-given rights. Well, of course, they don't believe we have any God-given rights because they hate God. And that's why, in many, even our textbooks, they will quote the Constitution, and they'll just put little dots where certain of those things are that talk about all men were created equal and endowed by their Creator, and they'll just take out that endowed by their Creator. Why? Because, of course, this is a conspiracy against God. Well, we're just about out of time. Mike, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners tonight?
Well, I would, you know, in your caller a moment ago talked about in the article that Roy Moore wrote that was in the Wall Street Journal. It's called In God I Trust. We're going to put that up on the website, and I just wanted to just quote real briefly from there. He says, "My decision to disregard the unlawful order of the federal judge was not civil disobedience, but the lawful response of the highest judicial officer of the state to his oath of office." We need, when there are champions in the field like this, when there are American heroes like this, when God gives us these champions, we need to support them.
Amen to that. And I understand that Judge Moore is going to be speaking at a meeting. I think maybe you and I will be attending in Virginia in about 4 weeks. So I think that that's really going to be exciting.
I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, fine. Well,
thank you very much for your hospitality. It's been great to be with you.
And thank you for staying up so late because it's almost midnight back there in Annapolis. But God bless you. Thanks so much, Mike.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And, of course, this is the time I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. We're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs on a regular basis to help us. And if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, it's as simple as picking up your telephone and calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And, of course, if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, we'd be glad to get you one. We encourage you to go to our website, which is radioliberty.com. And what will you find there? Well, you find our regular letters, and you need to get those letters out. You need to study them. You need to check the documentation and, of course, determine if what we're saying is true, because we really are telling the truth. There is a conspiracy against God at the highest levels of our government, and when a nation's leaders have turned against God, how long do you think that society is going to survive? So go to our website, radioliberty.com, and, of course, go to our letters, read the various treatises we have there. You'll certainly want to read our latest newsletter, the July-August newsletter, which goes into the planned genocide and racial genocide that is intended. And, of course, you can listen to our new programs. Many of them are archived. You can listen 5 hours a day and not get anything accomplished. But your job out there in listening audiences is to get other people to listen every evening to this program. Your job is to get people to go to our website and get them regularly listening to our programs. And then, of course, pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But lastly, of course, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until Monday, when I'll be back with you, there'll be a program tomorrow night. But until Monday, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us right now Eric Huffschmidt, and he's put together an interesting and very interesting book on the attack on the Twin Towers on September 11th of the year 2001. And, of course, he has some wonderful, wonderful pictures there that are very, very thought-provoking and make you sort of wonder, are we getting the entire story of what happened that day? You know, there certainly is no question at all that they knew some sort of an air attack was coming. We know that as of 1993, there was a book called Target America. It was written by Joseph Badansky, who was the director of research on terrorism and unconventional warfare for the House of Representatives. And, of course, in his book, Target America, written in 1993, he talked about how there were training camps in Iran, and it was in the early 1980s, where they actually had 747s and 707s and other American airliners, and they were training terrorists at that time to hijack the planes so they could crash them into our buildings. Now, that was in the early 1980s. And yet, of course, Condoleezza Rice and Dick Cheney said, whoever would have thought of something like that happened? That's what they said after the attack. What's really so interesting about that book is try to get a copy through regular channels. They're almost impossible to get. They are still available in some of the libraries. But, of course, it's almost as if somebody has removed those books from circulation, at least if you want to go out and buy one. It's very hard to get. Now, who would have done that? Who could have done that back in 1993, and why would they have done that? It's sort of like, well, sort of like those that article about Willie Brown being notified the evening before, on the, about 10 o'clock on the 10th of September, by the security agent that he should be very careful about flying the following day. And that article appeared just one time in the San Francisco Chronicle on the 12th, and that was almost as if somebody pulled it out of all the subsequent editions of the San Francisco Chronicle published that day, and either didn't put it up on the Internet, as they always do, or pulled it down off the Internet. And who has the power to pull articles out of newspapers and down off the Internet? And the same thing happened with Salman Rushdie's article, published, I think, on the 20th of September in the London Times. And, of course, where Salman Rushdie said, well, gee, I was told not to fly on American planes or Canadian commercial aircraft on the 3rd of September, so I think the government knew the attack was coming. And that article was published in the London Times, but somebody pulled it down off the Internet. Who would have the power to do that, and why would they do that? And then the story of the passports that supposedly were found adjacent to the World Trade Center and adjacent to the crash site in Pennsylvania where these flaming infernos were, but amazingly enough, both of those magic passports survived, and they were, one of them was even up on the FBI website until somebody pulled it down. And well, it almost looks like somebody might have planted them there. And then why would they have taken it down off the FBI website if it was legitimate? And if it wasn't legitimate, why would they put it up on the FBI website? And, well, there's so many questions that, Eric, that need to be raised. But right now, let's talk to Eric. Hi, Eric. How are you doing?
Nice to be back on your show.
Well, it's good to have you back. And why don't you tell our listeners just a little about who you are and how you happened to write this book?
Well, I develop software for a living. I'm not a journalist or author by profession. But since I'm on the computer all the time, I started noticing these people on the Internet that are referred to as conspiracy nuts. They were complaining about the attack and, as you mentioned, all these suspicious aspects. And initially, I didn't know what they were talking about, but eventually they got through to me and I started looking into it. And so then I started looking at the photos and the news reports, and I came to the conclusion there is something seriously wrong with the way our government is explaining this attack. You know, those towers, they didn't just fall over. They didn't just break into two pieces. They completely pulverized all the way into the basement. And then there was Building 7. That one completely pulverized also.
And it wasn't even hit by one of the planes, was it?
No, and it went down in the evening, 5:30 in the evening.
And it went down from the bottom, you know. It didn't come down from the top. It went down from the bottom. It looked like those hotels that they blow up in Las Vegas. Have you ever seen those pictures?
And the amazing thing is how few people even know about it. The news reports really ignored that entire building. And so I initially started contacting people through email, like at NASA and university professors, and saying, you ought to look into this. Something's strange here. And they all just ignore me. Nobody seems to be interested. So I decided, well, if nobody else is going to talk about this, I'll put a book together. So I took all the photos and explained it all as to why it looks like something is seriously wrong. Those towers look like they would... it planted with explosives, that the whole thing is just a big fake, just to make us angry, to justify wars, to justify new legislation, to justify changes in our government. And that's exactly what's been going on. It's what some people have been writing about for years, like the Operation Northwoods and, you know, all these other attacks.
Well, now, what is Operation Northwood for our listeners who don't know what that is?
Well, back in the 1960s, I think this was written in the early 60s.
In about 1962.
Yes, that's what I remember. Someone was thinking, you know, we've got to get people angry at something to justify a war with Cuba or...
No, we wanted to go to war with Fidel Castro. We wanted, after the failure of the Bay of Pigs, they wanted to be able to justify going to war. But how are you going to get the American people to go along with that?
That's the problem. So they have to find some way to make them angry. And so that was this whole scam. I suppose you probably know a whole lot more about it since you discussed these issues so much. But
Basically, what it was a plan put together by the Joint Chiefs of Staff. How would we get the American people to be willing to go to war with Fidel Castro? Well, what we could do is blow up some of our own boats in Guantanamo Harbor in Cuba and accuse Fidel Castro of killing some Americans. Or we could, have some Cubans. We could get them out of Miami and we'd dress them up in Cuban uniforms, and we could pretend that they attacked Guantanamo, and then we could kill them, and then we could, I mean, who's to say who they are? We've got these dead Cubans in Fidel Castro's uniform, so we could blame him for it. Or, you know, we could certainly shoot down some of our own planes and kill some of our own people, and that would certainly get the American people inflamed. But the most brilliant idea was the airliner. And that was an airliner that was supposed to be filled with young people going home to South America for the holidays. And so they were going to be put onto, and this is all in the report, because we have the report. It was top secret. It's been declassified. It's covered in James Bamford's book, Body of Secrets, or you can get the complete report in our syllabus on Iraq, the Untold Story. But, of course, they were going to have these children board the plane. Everybody would see them off. And, of course, the plane then would soar down south towards Cuba. It would drop down momentarily beneath the radar. And another plane, identical, would of course, take its position and continue south over Cuba. Now, the plane with the people on it, everybody had seen, would land. And then the people would just go home because they were all actors. But the plane would go over Cuba and would announce, Mayday, Mayday, we're under attack. By Cuban MiGs, and then the plane would explode, and now we would have an excuse to go to war with Cuba. That was the Operation Northwood. It was cleared by General Lemitzer, who was head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was cleared, apparently, by Robert McNamara, and President Kennedy said, no way are we going to do something like that. This is just wrong. And, of course, so that was the end of Operation Northwood. And it was actually kept top secret for almost 30 years, almost 40 years. But it is released. We have copies of it. And, of course, it is also covered in James Bamford's remarkable book, Body of Secrets, which we do carry here at Radio Liberty. So, Eric, go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, that's sort of what seems like happened here on September 11th. But this was a much bigger scale. And this time, there really were dead bodies. It wasn't just an imitation of some deaths. This was real deaths, and this was apparently to get people angry enough to justify bombing Afghanistan.
But, of course, you know, they were really rather nice about it because somebody bought up all those seats on those airliners. Now, are we to believe that Osama bin Laden or Sheikh Mohammed, purchased all those Sikhs, because actually on one plane, a great big plane, there were only 33 passengers. Less than a quarter of the seats on those four planes were filled. So somebody obviously bought up all the seats there so that there wouldn't be so many people killed. And that was very thoughtful, Osama bin Laden, or was it Osama bin Laden that bought up all those seats? And nobody's ever bothered to ask that question. Why weren't those planes more filled at that time of morning? Because I very frequently fly on those early flights, and they are usually packed full.
Right. And then the attack on the Pentagon also. This nice Arab or Al-Qaeda terrorist decided to swirl around the Pentagon in a 270-degree turn and hit the empty section that was under renovation. So there were very, very few deaths. And that building, since it holds 20 or 30,000 people, it's like a little city. So this terrorist decided to hit the empty section.
And you know, there are missiles there, missile batteries to protect the Pentagon. But gee, for some reason on that morning when we were on maximum alert, when they knew an attack might be coming, why those missiles weren't functioning? I wonder why not.
Yeah, see, we're expected to believe that 19 of these hijackers, and some of them are very young, too. They were starting as practically teenagers in their training. We're supposed to believe that these 19 people could defeat the U.S. Air Force, the FBI, the CIA, the air traffic controllers. I mean, if that's true, I mean, can you imagine if a couple hundred of them attacked us? I mean, this is ridiculous to think that those guys could to outsmart so many people and so many agencies. So, I mean, even if it were true that they did really attack us and they did really outsmart us, we still have a problem. It's no matter how you look at it, our government is either incredibly incompetent or the whole thing is a big lie.
Well, I think its best explanation is in a book called See No Evil by Robert Baer. And in the foreword of that book, written by a CIA agent, a former CIA agent, he quotes one of the highest-ranking CIA officials as having told a reporter off the record that when the smoke finally settles after September 11th, the American people will realize this was not a failure for American intelligence agencies. It was a triumph for American intelligence agencies. Now, how could the deaths of 3,000 Americans in the Twin Towers and on the planes and in the Pentagon be a triumph? Unless, of course, they intended for it to happen?
Well, that's about all you can come to the conclusion. And when you look at what happened on that day, and then you look at our government's response to it, our government didn't even want to investigate it. You've heard about the stock exchange, you know, the suspicious stock options that people were buying, millions of dollars worth of profits made on betting that United Airlines and American Airlines stock would drop. We had an investigation into that. The Chicago Board of Exchange announced they were going to investigate and discover who those people were. We had agencies in other countries even saying they were going to investigate also, and yet nothing came of it.
Well, actually, of course, there was a lot of trading over in Europe, and I have an article by the head of the German Bundesbank, the German central bank, who said, yeah, obviously, somebody knew it was going to happen. The same thing from the head of the French central bank. I said, obviously, somebody knew it was going to happen. So they were shorting over there as well. But isn't it interesting? We never found out who it was. Well, actually, we did. And, of course, there's several reports that they were people associated with the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, that's what the only reports that we did find out about is the suspicion that they were involved, and that's why nothing came of it. And then after, we also have President Bush and Dick Cheney making requests to Tom Daschle to limit the investigation. I mean, we have the biggest crime that's ever occurred, and our top government officials want to limit the investigation
of
it?
Well, that's really in the name of national security, because we don't want Muhammad Atta to find out what we knew about him.
Right, as they already defeated us completely. They outsmarted everybody, and yet we're worried now that they might find out what. I mean, see, it's so obvious when a crime is committed and our own government says, well, let's not look into it.
No, well, of course, it's in the national security. Everything is in the interest of national security, but maybe we don't want Osama bin Laden to know what we knew ahead of time, or is it possible we don't want the American people to learn the truth? Could that be a possibility?
That's the only thing that really makes sense, especially when you look at some of the photos that they do not show very often, such as the tower as it comes down or Building 7 as it comes down. How often have you even seen the video of Building 7? You remember when that attack first occurred, the TV shows were showing over and over those planes hitting the towers, and they showed you Osama's face. But how often did they show you Building 7 as it collapses? You see, they're giving you very selective news sources, very selective video here. They're only showing you what they want you to see. And the very suspicious stuff, like the collapse of Building 7, they just ignore.
We've actually got that caught on a video called The Grand Deception, as well as a lot of other great footage shot those first few days, at least in the first day. And, of course, you begin to realize that, and I realized just a few hours into this, somebody was orchestrating this. Somebody was using music and pictures of, dust, stained faces and tears to manipulate the emotions of the American people. And when I realized that, I realized maybe nothing we're seeing here is exactly as it made out to be, and the pictures burned into our subconscious of Tom Brokaw there sitting, of course, in the studio, and portrayed on the screen behind him, of course, is the smoke billowing from the Twin Towers still standing, the black smoke, and, of course, this somber face talking about what happened that day. But, of course, what they were doing was playing games with our emotions. For as the leaders of the small group known as the Project for the New American Century had said in their report in September of 2000, just 12 months before September 11th, 2001, the transformation that we seek in our military will take a long time unless, of course, there is a catastrophic and catalytic event like a new Pearl Harbor.
Right. They wanted something like Pearl Harbor, something so big that they would get everybody angry, and then they could justify all sorts of things.
I mean, going to war with Saddam Hussein because 15 Saudis and Osama bin Laden and had attacked the World Trade Center, and we know that the Saudis, our good friends, had been financing al-Qaeda both before and during the attack and subsequent to the attack, and yet, of course, now we're going to go to war first with Afghanistan and then with, of course, Iraq. But the plan on Iraq was, the attack on Iraq was actually laid out in 1998. And those of you who haven't been to the Project for the New American Century's website, that newamericancentury.org, that's newamericancentury.org, pull down the Statement of Principles published in June of the year 1998. Pardon me, 1997, the letter in 1998 written by this group of neoconservatives to President Clinton calling for a war with Saddam Hussein, and then, of course, their Rebuilding America's Defenses report published in September of the year 2000, where actually they call for the permanent station of American troops in Iraq. And, of course, the need for that supersedes the regime of Saddam Hussein. In other words, it doesn't matter whether Saddam is there or not. We want American troops permanently stationed in Iraq and the Middle East. That's what it's all about, ladies and gentlemen. But, of course, they can't tell the American people that. We're supposed to believe that we knew Saddam was about to attack us with his weapons of mass destruction.
Right. And you can even see the preparations from people like the editor of U.S. News and World Report and the oil companies as they, in 1998, an oil company executive was even complaining at the U.S. government that they need a new government in Afghanistan in order to get an oil pipeline through. I mean, they're actually complaining to our own government to do something about the government in Afghanistan.
Well, I think if you saw the news tonight, you find out that Halliburton now, that Dick Cheney used to be the CEO of, and still gets a deferred salary. Now, I don't know why he's getting a deferred salary from Halliburton, because, of course, he's works full-time as the Vice President of the United States. But isn't it interesting that Halliburton is going to make many millions, billions of dollars, several billions of dollars on non-competitive bids? In other words, they're just going to give them the bids. They're not going to compete with somebody else to see who can do it the cheap or the best. They're just going to give Halliburton several billion dollars for the work they're doing over there in Iraq. Does anybody think that there might just be some sort of a relationship between Halliburton and their former CEO, who is still getting a deferred salary from them?
I know, it's so blatant. And they even tell you, if you look at the news reports, you can even see them making remarks about how they're even changing the government to be more like they want it to be. Like in April of 2002, President Bush even says, he's approving changes at the U.S. military to make the military more supportive of the administration's goal. Of course, he doesn't tell you what are the administration's goals.
Well, I can tell you what it is. It's a world empire. That's what it's all about. America is going to dominate the world, and I don't want to dominate the world. Because I know what happened to Rome when they tried to do it. I know what happened to Greece when they tried to do it. I know what happened to Great Britain when they tried to do it. I know what happened to Russia when they tried to do it. And the same thing's going to happen to America.
Well, it's already happening.
People wake up.
Yes, it's already happening. Our economy is we cannot forever support wars around the world. This is what everyone who tries to take over the world forgets how big the world is. They don't seem to understand. You've got to support a lot of people, a lot of soldiers. You've got to fight enormous amounts of people. How can you continuously support this? And so here we're going to find ourselves the same way, just like you said, with Russia, with Nazi Germany, with Rome. The same thing. Wars all over the place, and meanwhile our economy is just going to deteriorate. Anger is going to be generated around the world towards America. I mean, there's already people in other countries advocating a boycott of American products. It's just going to get worse.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the pictures you have of the World Trade Centers, and what did you find as you studied the pictures of what happened that day and the explosions, or let's put it this: we're told, of course, what happened was the upper towers simply collapsed on the lower towers, and of course that simply crushed them, and because of the way the building was built, it just collapsed like a deck of cards.
Right, they tell us that the fires were responsible for bringing these towers down, because obviously the airplanes didn't do it. The airplanes hit the buildings. The buildings did not even shake enough for anybody to visually observe shaking. The people inside the buildings felt them tilt a little, but it was like a winter storm pushing the towers a little. The airplanes were big, but those towers were so strong, they just swallowed up the airplanes and then stood there.
Well, have you heard stories about, for instance, an explosion, and I think it was in the North Tower on the 21st, 22nd floor where the FBI headquarters were? And of course, there was nothing down there, and yet apparently those areas were totally destroyed when people went back looking for survivors. You know, have you heard those stories?
I've heard, well, there's a lot of stories. There's even stories like the windows down in the lobby had even blown out, which... Some of the windows down there had even blown out. There was also a report that in the basement, somebody was down in the basement, and there was something had gone off down there also, as if somebody had set explosions off down in the basement. So there apparently was a lot of things going on. But, of course, our government will not look into any of them. And so all we have are these scattered witnesses claiming these things. What we really have to go by are these photos. Because that can, and the seismic data and the video, because that nobody can argue with. I mean, it's possible that our government will say, well, the witnesses were wrong, it wasn't the 22nd floor, or, you know, they can always argue against us, but what they'll never be able to argue against is the seismic data, the video, and the photos.
All right, what does the seismic data show? What are the videos, pictures, what are the videos? Let's talk about the seismic data first.
Okay, well, you look at the collapse of these buildings, first of all. They're 110 stories tall, and both of them collapsed in 8 to 10 seconds. The South Tower took a little bit longer, but 8 to 10 seconds. These things are so tall, to understand how fast they fell down, if you were to go to the top of one of those towers and drop a brick off of it, it would take about 8 to 10 seconds to hit the ground. Now, this means these towers were falling down as fast as objects would fall, just through the air, as if they were not touching anything. But we're supposed to believe that as they were falling, they kept hitting the floor underneath it and cracking that one, and then all that rubble would fall and hit the floor below it. Now imagine if that were true. If that were true, one floor hits the floor below it, and then they hit the floor below that. That's like a ball falling down a staircase. It would go thump, thump, thump. It would take more than 8 to 10 seconds for 110 floors to do that. These floors were collapsing faster than you can blink your eye. And so how do you explain that? How could any building fall down so fast that it wasn't even, you know, there's no resistance. It is never, no floor ever hit any of the other floors. They were apparently being blown up so that as one floor was about to hit the floor below it, that floor shattered from explosives. And then all that rubble then fell down. But before they hit the floor below it, that floor was shattered. So nothing was ever hitting anything. They were just free-falling. The entire building free-fell.
But, of course, is there any evidence that there was explosions there? I mean, certainly some people feel that simply the superincumbent weight of this tremendous weight above, you know, once it broke loose, it would hit, and then, of course, it would destroy the floor, and then that would fall to hit the next floor, to fall to hit the next floor. At least that is the theory that we're told. And with such force, that sort of everything was pulverized, and the cement was turned into dust.
Well, that's what we're supposed to believe, that this thing is built basically like a gingerbread house, but if you look at some of the photos, I even have full-page ones of these particular ones because they're so interesting. Like on page 52 and 53 of the book, you can see puffs of dust flying horizontally out of the building. And if you've ever tried to throw dust, you know, it does not go very far. Only a tremendous force pushing it will be able to throw out a jet of dust horizontally like this. And yet it's coming out of a portion of the building that is structurally intact. So what we have here is in these photos is, before the building collapses, jets of dust come flying out of it, and then later the building collapses. And not only that, but these jets of dust, especially on page 54, they're in a horizontal line. They're going floor by floor so perfectly, so precisely. How can this possibly be just random chunks of flooring falling down? And then when you consider how fast they were going, it's just... And then you look at the, as it progresses, it just keeps expanding outwards hundreds and hundreds of feet. See, if the floors were simply falling, if one floor fell down onto the other, there would be a suction above that floor. The floor that's falling would create a suction. As it was blowing dust out from below, it would be sucking it back up. It'd be like a cigarette smoker who's blowing smoke out of his mouth and sucking it back up in his nose. That's not what we see going on in these pictures. We see dust constantly coming out, but never being sucked back up, which is a sign that there is increasing air pressure. Something is generating gas inside there, and which is why there's never a suction. And what can do that? Only explosives. They're adding hot, expanding gas, which is why there is no suction as these things fall down. And so the photos, and then you look at the rubble after it hits the ground, there's no pieces of anything. There's this short sections of steel beams. All the concrete is dust or grains of sand. All the office furniture, the elevators, the staircases, everything has been just completely pulverized all the way into the basement.
Well, now, didn't they have some inspectors in there to go through all the steel and to find out, of course, what really happened, because those pieces of steel that were at the levels where the planes hit and where supposedly this intense heat had actually caused the steel to fail. They would have had samples of that to show us, didn't they? Didn't they have that?
Well, they were supposed to have saved it. They were supposed to have let inspectors look at this, but this is one of the other things that's very suspicious about this whole attack. Immediately, there were cleanup crews on the site, cutting up the steel, hauling it away. Initially, they were saying, well, they were looking for survivors, which is justifiable. But they should have been putting this stuff away somewhere, you know, moving it to the side and then letting the inspectors look at it. But instead, they were selling the steel, the good pieces, to foreign nations as scrap metal and dumping the rest in landfills. Now, this may not seem like much, but the editor of Fire Engineering Magazine was complaining in an article that this is against the law, that if you've ever seen anything, any sort of crime, well, I guess we'll wait to the break, but this was a crime, is what he was saying. You cannot destroy evidence like that. And our government did it, and they did it deliberately, which is a sign that obviously something is... they had to have done it. There's no way this could have been an accident. They knew they were supposed to save all of this rubble for the inspection.
Well, Chris, were they just anxious to get it all cleaned up? We'll cover this, and we'll invite your calls when we get back at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Love to get your thoughts. If you agree or disagree, that's what Talk Radio is all about. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Eric Huffman. And Eric, before I forget this, why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners how they can get copies of your book?
Well, they can go on the Internet. There's one place is dpgear.com. That's just DP, like dangerous places, and then gear, like transmission gear. If they just want to call somebody, there's a few places selling it now, like the Power Hour radio show at 877-817-9829. But the Internet site is the easy way to find it. Just search for painful questions.
All right, fine. Painful questions or dpgear, G-E-E-R.com. Okay, fine. So if anybody has any questions at all for Eric, just feel free to call in. Well, now, what were the most significant things you saw on the pictures? Because where did you get those beautiful pictures? Incidentally, they really are quite dramatic.
Well, some of them, this is another interesting thing, because as you know, whenever something happens that the news reporters consider exciting, they all fight with each other to get it on their front page of the Time magazine or Newsweek. And yet some of these photos that are in this book are available through Reuters, and yet you don't see them anywhere. I was surprised when I published that nobody had seen these pictures. Some of them are just, I just had to search all over the Internet for. They're not available easily, but some of these are just Reuters photos or Associated Press, and yet they've been hidden all these for now, almost 2 years. And so it's a sign, this alone, the sign that they are not, somebody does not want these to be seen.
Are you suggesting that somebody is concealing the facts or the truth or the pictures from the American public?
Well, yes, they are definitely, somebody has got to be, because normally you would want to show these pictures. They're interesting to look at. If nothing else, I mean, look at the South Tower as the top of it starts to fall over. This is something a lot of people didn't even notice. The entire top section of the South Tower started tipping over and started falling towards the ground onto building number 4.
Well, that always bothered me. I could see that start to tilt to one side, and it started to tilt to one side, and then how did it sort of straighten up again and come down straight? I just never quite understood that.
Well, apparently what happened, see, this is one of the big mysteries as to why and to what happened. And here we have a big chunk of tower, and people have to realize how big this tower was. These were 200 feet on each side. They're made of steel. These are not pieces of wood. These are steel structures. And this big chunk of it starts falling over, and then it gets lost in the dust of clouds and then vanishes. We look at later after the dust has settled, you can't find any piece of it. You can find pieces of steel, but you don't see any big structure anywhere. You don't see any office furniture. So where did this big chunk of building go to? It just vanished into the clouds of dust, and then later we just find pieces of it everywhere. And so my only explanation is, as it was falling down, explosives were going off, shattering it, and so by the time it hit the ground, there was nothing left but pieces. That's the only way I can explain this. And I show it in diagrams in the book just to help people understand what else can you do to explain this mystery. And so it's these photos that make this entire attack seem very suspicious. And also of Building 7, the rubble. This 47-story building compresses itself into this teeny little pile of rubble, just like you said, an old hotel being demolished, falling down exactly on its footprint without really going off to one side or the other, and dropping vertically, crumbling as it hits the ground. So it's the photos and the video that really make something look like this whole attack is just designed to make us angry, to justify who knows what, wars and changes to our government.
And maybe the USA Patriot Act, they have a new legislation they're going to put in. It's called the USA Victory Act. Isn't that wonderful? And, of course, it's going to further, of course, restrict our freedoms, because, of course, that's how we're going to have victory. But victory for who?
Right. And see, most people, since they believe these Al-Qaeda people have attacked us, they are willing to support this. See, the attack really did work from the point of view of the CIA. You know, it really did justify the anger, justified the war, and the people are truly behind it. Most people truly are still behind this. They still have not yet seen the information. They don't even, a lot of them do not even want to look at it. And especially the Pentagon, I think this is very difficult for people to face, the possibility that our own military attacked its own headquarters. I think a lot of people...
No, I don't think that the military was involved. I don't think that... I mean, if this... however it worked, you know, whatever happened, you know, I don't think the military as such was involved. There may have been some other people. Maybe we'd infiltrated Al-Qaeda, but certainly there were terrorists there, weren't there? There were 19 terrorists or 15 terrorists or some terrorists there?
Well, this is what's interesting is originally the FBI was saying some so-and-so Arab was the hijacker, the pilot of Flight 77 as it hit the Pentagon, and then later that particular person complained, hey, I'm over here in Saudi Arabia. What's my name doing up there on that list?
Well,
and here we got the FBI putting up pictures and names of these people within, what was it, a day and a half?
Well, just about a day and a half or 2 days. I think that the article appeared on the... on the 15th, but it was actually written on the 14th, and it was based upon information that had been sent from the FBI to German intelligence and leaked to Der Spiegel and sent from Der Spiegel back to the United States, where it was then put into a full-page article, and it would take me about 4 days to write that article, but, you know, if I was writing it. So it was the most amazing thing that really within relatively, at most 48 hours, we knew who all the terrorists were. We knew who was piloting the planes, although nobody survived the planes. We knew where all of these men lived. We knew where all of them went to school. We knew so much about them. And the most amazing thing, as Eric has said, a recent article in Insight magazine points out that at least six of the hijackers are alive and well over in the Middle East. And, of course, the FBI says, well, maybe somebody stole their identity, but we're convinced that these are the people because we've got their pictures. And the guy says, that's my picture, and I'm perfectly alive. And isn't it interesting that none of the media other than Insight magazine picked up that story? We have it, if anybody out there is interested. Now, but, of course, the trouble is it sounds so ridiculous. And, of course, one of the reasons was, of course, the Mueller of the FBI was asked, how can you be sure who these people were? And his reply was, well, we have their passports. Now, wait a minute. How did you get their passports? Well, you know, of course, he didn't go into detail about the passport that was found by the World Trade Center building, the other passport that survived the fiery inferno that destroyed everything in Pennsylvania, except a passport was slightly singed, and that was the one that was in the FBI file. They took those down, as I mentioned earlier, and why would they have taken it down if it was legitimate? And if it wasn't legitimate, why would they have put it up there and named the man on the passport as one of the hijackers? And there's something very strange about the entire story.
Right. And then we also have this Flight 77 flying. The military tells us that it flew only a few feet above the cars, the highway. It was knocking down light poles. And yet, if you look through the news reports, you can't find anybody talking about the noise of this airplane. You know, a 757 has 2 9-foot diameter engines. And there is no way an airplane that size can fly 400 miles an hour over cars that close without people making remarks about the deafening noise. Anybody who's been near an airport knows these sort of planes are not at all quiet. And yet there's no reports of the noise. I mean, nothing about the attack on the Pentagon makes any sense. You've got a plane flying inches above the cars, yet nobody hears the noise. It crashes into the Pentagon, but then the first photos of the Pentagon don't even show holes or pieces of the airplane anywhere or passengers or luggage. They've got a dog. They've got some photos of a dog searching for people in the Pentagon and around the Pentagon, and it never found any of them. And so we have this is the most suspicious part of the attack, but the military is so secretive that they don't let much information out, and a lot of people don't know about this. But it's a very, very odd attack that these people could outsmart the U.S. military, and then the entire plane vanishes, and all the people vanish. I mean, these are some tricky hijackers here to get rid of that. And a lot of people think, well, you know, maybe it's a scam, but so what? Look at what's going on in the rest of the world. Initially, we had a lot of sympathy when this attack first occurred. But then, through the months, as other nations started to look at this, they started complaining. The French started at Pentagon, for example. They looked at the photos and said, I don't see any plane. And Terry Masson wrote a book soon about it. You know, and slowly, what's happening around the world is people are becoming angry at us. They're starting to realize, you know, this attack does not look real, and it's creating anger towards us. And for Americans to say, well, maybe it wasn't a tag, maybe it was a little bit of a lie, maybe Bush knew, but then they ignore it. But how can you ignore something like this? It's creating tremendous anger towards America now.
And American boys are dying almost every day over in Iraq. And, of course, how long will we be there? We're going to be there indefinitely because the plan, long before the September 11th attack, was to permanently station American troops in the Middle East. And if you doubt that, you go to their website, which is newamericancentury.org, and you read their Rebuilding America's Defenses report. It's all there. Or you can get my newsletter, my March newsletter of this year, and we give you the exact references where to look and the report of the neocons. Now, what are the neocons? Well, of course, they are people who believe in a fascist society. They're old-line Marxists who didn't like communism, so they want to install a Marxist society here. And, of course, there many of them are disciples of Leo Strauss, a professor at University of Chicago who came to America to escape Nazism. Leo Strauss's biographer called him a Jewish Nazi because this is what he wanted, a ruling elite to control us common folks who aren't smart enough ever to ask any questions, just go along with the flow.
Well, that's exactly what the attitude seems to be. The common people are not going to do anything. This seems to be the whole attitude of who's ever behind these scams. They're looking at the American people and, well, everybody in every country as, you know, a herd of cattle that never think, never do anything, and they're just sitting there waiting to be exploited, and that seems to be what's going on. The September 11th attack is just one of many of these scams. I mean, if you look at the Oklahoma City attack, it's a very, very similar attack. It was buildings being blown up while people were inside, except that instead of airplanes to grab your attention, they had a truck bomb. But it was the same type of an attack. There was one single person there to grab your attention, and Tim McVeigh was a person to hate. Meanwhile, there were explosives already set inside the building, ready to go off.
You mean you're talking about Osama McVeigh?
Right, the same person, It was like a Hollywood sequel. September 11th is like a sequel to that, except on a bigger scale. It was the same type of thing: explosives in a building, just waiting. Then they had, instead of a truck bomb, they used airplanes, and instead of Tim McVeigh, they had these Al Qaeda people. But it's the same type of an attack. They've been successful with it, and they're just, it seems like they're building up confidence to get bigger and bigger, and it just makes you wonder what is going to happen next. Since there's apparently nothing to stop them. So it's a possibility that unless the whole U.S. economy collapses from these endless wars, that there will be more of these. And that's the most amazing thing, is the apathy.
Well, of course, within the last several days, President Bush has commented how we're going to have to destabilize both Iran and Syria, and it's only a matter of time before we do that. And I will tell you that, from my information, we're already in the process of destabilizing Iran, and I'm sure we're doing the same thing with Syria, and, of course, if they do not collapse, why, we'll, of course, send more American boys over there to fight and bleed and suffer and die. But Henry Kissinger, who is a good friend of our president's, in fact, he was on the advisory committee that elected the president, and, of course, it was Henry Kissinger that George W. Bush asked to head the investigation of the 9/11 attack. But Henry Kissinger is quoted in a book called The Final Days by Woodward and Bernstein, and anybody wants the page references, it's in the 1992-97, somewhere in there, saying that the military is simply stupid, dumb animals to be used for military purposes. The military are stupid, dumb animals to be used for our foreign policy. So you have to understand how the leaders of our country look upon the young boys that were asking to go over there and risk their lives. Somehow we're fighting for freedom over in Iraq. Do you honestly believe that? And if you don't, then what are you going to do about it? Are you going to just sit there and do nothing? Or are you going to get involved in this epic struggle with us to try to preserve the greatest nation that God has ever allowed to be on this earth? And I really believe that. And yet, of course, it's being lost because good people are doing nothing. But men and women become accomplices of the evils they fail to oppose. And by not doing anything, you become part of the problem. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. give us a call if you agree, if you disagree. Our guest is Eric Hufschmidt. And Erica, how is your book moving?
Well, it's actually, it's hard to say since I've, you know, all of these types of books, they're in a very low market compared to something like Harry Potter books or, you know, the entertainment is what really sells in this country. These books are still going slow. Everything about Oklahoma City, September 11th attack, you know, all of these are, people are resisting them. The majority of people resist it. It's like you were just mentioning, you know, or, you know, people, if people want to do something, they need to help out. But a lot of people have this attitude like, what can I do? What can I do? But it's easy. All you have to do is start talking about things. Spreading the information is the most important. But people, they're depressed by it. Some people will resist looking at my book, the pictures especially. It bothers them to think that the possibility that this whole attack was a big scam. And so there is a tremendous resistance. I hate to say it, but there is a tremendous resistance to just looking at the pictures. Yet there are, but we see, here's another thing, another point that people should think about before they get depressed about this, and that is, this country, when it was founded, was not founded by the majority of people. It was a small group that just said, let's do something, let's break away, we'll start a new nation. The majority did not get involved. And if Jefferson and others had tried to say, well, let's get the majority's opinion first, let's get them involved, nothing would have happened if they had done that. So what I say is, don't get depressed when the majority of people ignore these attacks, because they're always going to ignore it. They're always going to ignore it, and it has happened all throughout history. It's only going to be a small group. If something good comes about, it will be a small group that decides, we can't take it any longer. Let's do something.
Well, you know, it's amazing how few people are on the other side. I mean, you have your Council on Foreign Relations, about 3,000 members, but it was your PNAC group, which is the CFR Front, starting with 25 people and really having not more than 50 people at the present time, are the center of this neocon movement that has taken over our government. And who are these people who are part of this movement, this project for the new American century? Why, Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and John Bolton and, of course, Gary Bauer and Frank Gaffney and William J. Bennett and Irving Kristol, whose son William Kristol heads the group today, and Mitch Dechter. And you can go down the line. You can get all the names off of their website. They actually, of course, they put out their statement of principles in June of 1997, and their names are all there. 25 people started the organization. I don't think there's more than 50 today. It's still a CFR Front. But, you know, these are the people who control our government. If 50 people can really control the policies of our government, why, we ought to be able to find 100 or 200 Americans who are willing to take a stand against them.
Right. It's like the Wizard of Oz, where everybody's afraid of the big and powerful wizard, and really, if you look behind the curtain, what is there? Not that many people. If the U.S. military, if there were just enough people there to say they've had enough of this, they could do something by themselves.
Well, you know,
waking them up.
Somebody gave me a little list of quotations the other day, and one of them was attributed to the Wizard of Oz, and of course I don't think it was accurate, but he said, well, I can't give you a brain, but I can give you a diploma. I can't give you a brain, but I can give you a diploma, meaning I can't make you smart, but I can give you a degree from college, and you'll appear to be smart, and you know, but of course that's a rather frightening thing. We've got all these people who are educated far beyond their intelligence.
Right, and they create the illusion that people, there's an illusion like we're under the control of all these terrible people, but, I mean, there's so many people that if they, all you need is another group to stand up to them and say, look, we've had enough of this, let's fix this country. It doesn't take that many people. But it's getting the information out, it's not getting depressed when these, what you might call the ordinary people, ignore you. It's getting the information out, especially the military, who are really resisting. They seem to have it's part of their culture, if you want to call it culture, to just obey without question. So,
well, I'll tell you what, the morale is so low over there. And the people there, of course, they've been told they're coming home. You're going to be home in June. You're going to be home in July. You're going to be home in August. Why, we could just as soon have Bill Clinton in the White House. He lied to the troops that everybody will be out of Bosnia by November. He just didn't say November of what year. And, of course, the American troops are still there. Well, they're doing the same thing with our boys over there in Iraq. You know, I think they're going to bring them home one of these days. But I'll tell you what, you're in 120 degrees of heat. You're wearing this body armor. You don't know when you or your buddy is going to get shot or wounded. We've already had over 1,000 casualties, and many of these people have severe wounds that'll be with them the rest of their life. We've lost equally a number of people killed, since the end of the war, as we had before the war. We only lost 120, 110 during the war, and we've had far more than that killed since the end of hostilities. And, of course, we're doing everything we can to antagonize the Iraqis. And, of course, they're shooting civilians for no reason at all, other than the fact that these kids are scared to death over there. They're afraid that they don't know who their enemies are. And sometimes somebody will drive up in a car full of kids, and they don't understand it. And they can't speak their language, and they kill them all. And what do you think that does for the Iraqis feeling about Americans? And of course, those young men who've killed innocent civilians are going to have to carry that with them all the rest of their lives, when they get home and they really think about what's happened. War is a terrible, terrible thing, and a lot of our boys who went over to Vietnam remember all the people and the innocent people who got killed. They didn't do it intentionally. When you're in war, you have to survive, and you have to sometimes kill civilians because you don't know who the enemy really is. But, of course, it's against the normal tendency of human beings to want to kill other human beings. And I'll never forget, I had one of my patients had been, in Vietnam, and his job was to go out at nighttime, crawl through the rice paddies and kill the Viet Cong. And, he was just, just psychologically, he was just a basket case. He will never get over what happened there.
And then when you consider what we could be doing with our time and our money and our effort, we could be making nice cities for ourselves. We could be improving our life and impressing the world. We could be showing the world that we really are the best country. We have the nicest cities, the nicest economy, the nicest jobs. We have a nice place to work and live. Instead, what are we doing? Just war after war after war, hatred, hatred, and more hatred. I mean, what sort of a nation is this becoming? When we, almost all of our money is going into bombs and things, and nothing is to really help us. Nothing is really to impress the world with our talents or inspire other nations to develop better governments. We're not inspiring other nations to become better people. We're just making them angry and causing them to want more weapons.
Well, my fear is, of course, we are the recruiting agency for Osama bin Laden. In 1979, when this whole thing began, there was really no Islamic terrorist movement. Yes, there was the Muslim Brotherhood. There were certainly some Arabs who disliked Israel, but they were not part of this radical Islamic movement. The only real radical Islamic movement existed within our good friends Saudi Arabia, and of course within the Wahhabi religion, but even that was restricted to the confines of Saudi Arabia. So there was no radical Islamic movement until began financing the opposition to the Soviets in Afghanistan and precipitated the Afghan War, and then brought soldiers, Islamic soldiers from all over the world to fight in this war against the infidels and begin buying textbooks for the Islamic children, telling them how wonderful it was to die for Allah, and indoctrinating them in the radical form of Islam, as we did with the Mujahideen. And then, of course, when the war ended, Osama bin Laden, who had been our CIA agent and whose family is very, very good friends with George Herbert Walker Bush, and Osama bin Laden, who was a Saudi, organized Al-Qaeda. And then who financed Al-Qaeda? Why, of course, it was financed by Saudi Arabia, by Pakistani intelligence, which is a surrogate of the CIA, and at least in parts of the world, by the CIA. How do we know that? We got a book written in 1999 talking about it, Dollars for Terror. And, of course, John Cooley's book, Unholy Wars, goes into the financing of Al-Qaeda. And, of course, we continued financing the Taliban. And, of course, the Saudis financed Al-Qaeda with our knowledge and support, not only prior to September 11th, but even after September 11th. And who's defending the Saudis from the lawsuits that are being brought by the families of the victims of 9/11? Why, the law firm of Baker and Hoyt, that Baker being James H. Baker III, the president's lawyer. There's something wrong about what's going on. And then if you read the recent investigative report, all 900 pages of it, you find out you've been told that there are 28 pages that were blacked out. And that, of course, is a half-truth, and a half-truth is really a lie, because